Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films, Blonde, Vesper, Control. And no, it's not a code. Hi, David. How are you?
Doing okay, Jill, this week. How about you?
I am all right, so to speak. I'm going to say I'm intrigued.
You're intrigued. Well, yeah, we've got 3 one-word titles this week, and I don't plan them this way. Sometimes that's just how it comes out. And I'd like to begin with Blonde, which is a movie that a lot of people are talking about and which is very controversial for all kinds of reasons. This is a movie which is written and directed by Andrew Dominik, and it is based on Joyce Carol Oates' novel about the famous Marilyn Monroe. And the thing is that Blonde is, obviously, it's about Marilyn Monroe, and that's her name in the movie. She's Norma Jean Baker, and then she becomes Marilyn Monroe and becomes this huge movie star and all of that. But a lot of it is made up as well. A lot of it is fantasy spun around the life of Marilyn Monroe. So it's not really a biopic. It's not really a biography. It isn't really telling us the story of the real Marilyn Monroe, nor is it a complete fiction that's just sort of vaguely based on Marilyn Monroe. It's somewhere a blend of the two. And that whole kind of concept makes me a little bit uneasy. When I'm looking at something, I rather do like to know whether somebody is giving me some version of the real story or whether somebody is making a lot of stuff up. And in this case of this project, it is some of both, and they're all intermingled. Anyway, the movie stars Ana de Armas as Marilyn Monroe, and yet we get it also stars other people as Marilyn Monroe, since we see her starting when she's a little girl, and then we see her through the whole cycle of her life, and then eventually at the end, of course, her tragic death at an early age. And Ana de Armas does a very good job of playing her. Ana de Armas, I guess she's probably best known for the recent movie Knives Out. But she's been in a bunch of stuff, and she certainly is talented. One of the problems I had with Blonde, and by the way, my feelings about the movie Blonde are very, very mixed, and sort of tending toward the negative side, but more about that in a moment. I didn't really think that she reminded me all that much of Marilyn Monroe. I mean, I'm a movie critic. I like movies. I've seen Marilyn Monroe a lot, and I'm very familiar with what she looks like on the screen, and I just didn't think that Ana de Armas really quite captured it. Just doesn't look all that much like her. Obviously, the general look is there. But anyway, just on the level of impersonation, I didn't think it was all that great a performance. On the level of sort of psychological interpretation of the character, I suppose it works a little bit better. It's a perfectly good, if not entirely convincing, portrayal of Marilyn Monroe. In any case, we start with Marilyn Monroe as the extremely troubled little girl with an extremely troubled, apparently psychotic mother, who is pretty soon put into an institution where she spends pretty much the rest of her days. So we start off discovering about the very very unhappy childhood of Marilyn Monroe, or Norma Jean Baker, as she was then named. And then we follow it up through her friendship with a couple of fascinating Hollywood characters. They're not really that fascinating. Edward G. Robinson Jr. and Charlie Chaplin Jr., who are a very, very seedy and cheesy pair of young men who are into all kinds of dubious, immoral stuff, and they become her very good friends, and they spend a lot of time together, and that's a whole big chunk of the movie. And then she becomes a Hollywood star. Of course, unfortunately, this has even all the more resonance today since the Me Too movement, but of course, she is sexually abused on her way to her Hollywood stardom, and she gets into the actor's studio, and so we have some of that. And she marries Joe DiMaggio, the famous baseball player, and so we have some of that. And then she marries Arthur Miller, the very great playwright, played here by Adrian Brody. Brody, and so we have some of that. And eventually, again, we wend our way to her unhappy end. There's also, and this is the big climax of the movie, and this is one of the reasons why the movie is so controversial, she has a sexual encounter on screen with President John F. Kennedy, which is extremely graphic in the sex department. And I found this scene to be nothing but vulgar, I have to say. Yes, we are meant to see it as an example of how poor Marilyn Monroe was genuinely exploited by all sorts of powerful people, including the President of the United States, and that's certainly a worthwhile and important thing to get across biographically and thematically. But my gosh, I found that big climactic concluding scene, almost concluding scene, to be just vulgar and coarse and crude, and I didn't like it. And it sort of pushed in the audience's face. And I'm not saying this because I am all that sensitive to sex on the screen. I'm a movie critic. I've seen plenty of that. But this is just I just didn't like it. It left a bad taste in my mouth, so to speak. So Blonde is technically very, very well done. Clearly, a very, very high-powered Hollywood crew was working on every aspect of this movie, and everything about it is beautifully put together. But ultimately, it just didn't amount to much for me. Again, I didn't like the mix of facts and fiction, which comes from the Joyce Carol Oates origins of the story. I wasn't especially pleased with Ana de Armas's portrayal of the main character, and I did not like the movie's descent into vulgarity, which happened more than once along the way. So I can't say I really recommend Blonde. Of course, there is still a great cult of people who are fascinated with Marilyn Monroe, and I'm glad to see a movie that doesn't hold back on its punches. It really, you know, gives you all the stuff you might expect to see in a Marilyn Monroe biopic. But on all kinds of levels, the movie disappointed me. Overall, when I was watching it, by the way, it's almost 3 hours long, you know, I wasn't put off by it most of the time, except for those descents into vulgarity, which I didn't much like, because technically it is very well done. It always looks splendid. Some of the special effects stuff, like a huge fire near the beginning, are very well handled. But ultimately, the movie sort of washed over me and didn't leave much impression at all. So for all the controversy and all the buzz and all the talk, I can say, if you want to leave Blonde alone, it's okay with me. You won't be missing a whole lot. Our second one-word title of the day, Jill, is Vesper, and we now turn to the world of fantasy and science fiction for our final two movies of today. Vesper is a post-apocalyptic tale. They are very common. We discover at the beginning that the entire planet Earth's the ecosystem has totally collapsed, leaving people to fend for themselves as best they can. And usually when movies are made about this sort of subject, the whole idea of civilization has perished and there is nothing left but the war of all against all. Usually it's the Mad Max kind of thing, full of action and spectacle and violence. Well, Vesper has moments of that along the way, yes, but the whole interesting thing about the movie Vesper is that it is very, very restrained. It is quiet. It is almost subtle at times, and that's a refreshing change. It's not a great movie by a long shot, but it is quiet and subtle, and it goes against the grain of the usual post-apocalyptic genre film. So we have here this young girl. She's about 13 years old. Her name is Vesper, and she is fending for herself, and she's also fending for her father, who is gravely ill, is completely confined to bed, can't get out of it, and she discovers early in the film that they are running out of power. Power is a precious commodity, and without more power to keep her father's life support apparatus going, he will certainly perish, and she will probably perish thereafter. So she really needs help with this. And by the way, as she travels about, she has this cute R2-D2 type robot that goes everywhere with her, except it's not a robot that walks along the ground. It's a robot that floats through the air. So this sort of drone robot is her almost constant companion throughout the film, and that's certainly not original. As I say, it reminded me of R2-D2, and there's been a jillion science fiction movies with adorable robots or clones that accompany the main character. This is one of those cases. So she travels about looking to get the power that she needs to help her father and running into various adventures. One of the people she has to deal with is a guy named Jonas, who is played by Eddie Marsan, and I want to say that I always associate Eddie Marsan, rightly or wrongly, with sort of over-the-top acting and over-the-type stuff. And even though he plays a villain in this movie, he also is rather restrained at least for Eddie Marsan, he's rather restrained in keeping with the tone of the movie as a whole. So anyway, he runs this sort of cult, and she needs help from him. And so she's got to sort of cooperate with him in some ways, even though he's a very, very bad guy. And then eventually she has to deal also with this this community called the Citadel. There are these citadels here and there scattered throughout the destroyed world. And they have a lot of resources and they have a lot of wealth and they have comparatively comfortable living. And so she's got to sort of get some help from them. And then she meets a girl from the or a young woman from the Citadel whose name is Camellia, who becomes another fairly major character in the movie. There are also these sort of humanoids, sort of androids who are called Jugs, and they also play a part in this story. So we have a lot of very familiar science fiction elements here. We have the androids, we have the adorable little robot clone kind of thing. We have the bad guy played by Eddie Marsan, you know, all the kinds of things that you're going to have in this kind of a movie. But I'll make my big point one more time, which is that if you're interested in the sort of post-apocalyptic genre, then you have to see Vesper, because it's an interesting entry in that genre or subgenre. But also it has this very interesting tone. It's almost gentle. It's almost delicate. It's sort of sweet the way it goes along, even though a lot of very bad stuff happens in the movie. And the main character, Vesper herself, is very nicely played by a young actor named Raphael Chapman. And the movie just has this interesting, engaging sort of tone. I like science fiction, although I found most science fiction of recent years to be rather uninspired. I can't say I found Vesper an exciting movie, but I did find it a refreshing change of pace from the usual movie that follows these lines. So again, if you're interested in science fiction, if you're interested in this particular subgenre of science fiction, then it's a movie that you really do have to catch up with, because it is just a nice little film in its own sort of offbeat way. And our final movie for today, Jill, Control, our third one-word title of the day. And Control also comes into it's becoming a more familiar subgenre of science fiction as we go along. It's the person alone in a room movie. And in this case, we have a woman who is alone in a room. Her name is Eileen, and she is right there from the beginning of the movie, and it's a very bad environment. The alone in a room movies usually are very, very unpleasant rooms to be in. So here she is. She's in this room. She has no idea how she got here. She has no idea where she is, except she's in this room. And suddenly, a loudspeaker is barking out a command to her in a woman's voice: break the pencil. Okay, actually, it's move the pencil at first. So there's a table over there in the room, and there's a pencil on the table, and she's supposed to move the pencil. So she moves the pencil. And then, okay, the next command is to break the pencil. Now she's got to break the pencil. However, as these commands continue, they get more and more seemingly impossible to do. For example, at one point, she is supposed to break the pencil, but there is now an impenetrable barrier between Eileen and the table with the pencil on it. So what is she supposed to do here? Also, by the way, she starts getting chained to the chair that she is in. So how is she going to get over to the table if she is chained to the chair that she is in? So that's the way this movie goes. We see that she's going to be confronted with an increasingly difficult series of commands, some of which appear to be almost impossible. So how do you sustain this over the course of a movie? Well, one thing that happens pretty early is that another character ends in the room. So it's really a two people alone in a room movie. And the other character is her husband, whose name is Roger. Now, the two of them are in the room, but when he tries to help her carry out her tasks, which she is given, then they are told that no, he's not allowed to help. She's got to do these things by herself, although he is allowed to give her advice. So that turns out to be another sort of parameter of the movie. And by the way, what happens if they don't carry out these commands? Their little girl daughter, who is being held somewhere outside the room, will be killed. So there's the setup for the movie as it becomes clear over the earlier scenes. Woman, man, room, impossible commands, daughter will be killed if you don't carry them out. Then it turns out that Eileen has some sort of psychic powers, which she has never been aware of before. And it turns out that she can fulfill a lot of these commands if she just learns how to use and control, that's the title of the movie, her psychic powers. powers. So that's the setup for this movie. I will reveal that eventually a little bit of stuff happens outside of the room, but mainly the movie takes place inside the room. And I have to say that the writer, the co-writer and director of this movie, James Mark, does a pretty good job of keeping the tension going and keeping the movie varied enough to keep watching. Even though it's largely in this room, there are some mildly good special effects. There's some creepy scenes of violence, and we have some cutaways to some earlier scenes, flashbacks, the little girl who is being held prisoner out on the beach with her parents, and the tension between the two parents who haven't really been getting along anyway. And, you know, the movie has a reasonable amount of variety for what is ultimately a one person and then two people in a room kind of a film. So Control, I'm sure it was put into production before the pandemic, but there do seem to be more of these alone in a room type movies since the pandemic. I have a feeling it's a way that the movies have of dealing with our sense of isolation and being cut off from other people. But I wish that movies would do it in more creative ways than Control does. It's an interesting movie, a mildly timely movie that has something to do with the times we live in, but it's ultimately an uninspired movie. And I just wish that Control were maybe a little bit less controlled and maybe cut loose a little bit more. It might have been more fun to watch. So that is my 3 one-word titles movie story this week, Joe.
For which we thank you, as ever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films Blonde, Vesper, and Control.